You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Well, hello, everyone. Good evening. My name is Zani Boyajian. I'm manager for research and special collections here at Central Library. And on behalf of Central Library and the Los Angeles Public Library, I want to welcome you here tonight. Whether you're a regular or it's your first time at Central, or if you're dipping your feet into in-person programming, like we all are after a long and stressful pandemic, we welcome you here. As librarians and library workers, every day is a little different, but the common denominator is building community. And every day we get to see how the library changes lives in big and small ways, whether it's helping somebody do genealogy research, start their own business, helping somebody with their citizenship, or just helping somebody in our Octavia Lab makerspace work on a sewing project or record their podcast or looking at a special item in the rare books room. It's all about building community, and we're really, really proud of the fact that our collections and services are free and accessible to everyone. We have two exhibitions at Central Library going on right now. You might have walked buy one on the way in here to the Taper, our Creators in Residence exhibition. And on the second floor in our Annenberg Gallery, we have our Shades of LA exhibition. We're celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Shades of LA project, which was really a seminal project in its day. Our photo curator asked Angelenos from all communities to share their family photos, which to include them on our digital collection site, tessa.lapl.org. On Wednesday night, an upcoming program alert, we're going to continue the conversation on censorship with a program entitled Censored, Free Speech in Hollywood, and that's in collaboration with PEN America and the Writers Guild, and we welcome you to that program. And for all our programs and more, we encourage you to look at our website, which we consider the 74th branch of the LAPL system, and take a copy of our calendar events on your way out today. And because we're librarians and we always encourage you to take a deeper dive, we have asked our special subject specialist to curate a list inspired by today's program, and that'll be sent to you tonight after the program. I'd like to take this opportunity to recognize and acknowledge the first people of this land, honor their elders past and present, as well as the descendants who are citizens of this nation. And for more information on which territory you may reside, feel free to check out native-land.ca. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Jessica Strand, Director of Public Programming for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, and wish you all an inspiring evening tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Ani. I'm Jessica Strand. I'm the Director of Public Programming, the Library Foundation, which you already heard. It's wonderful to see you all here this evening for this informative and compelling program. I'd like to thank the HFPA for their continued support and supporting this program. After tonight's program, we have one program left before the holiday season. We'd love you to join us. It's an evening with Patti Smith on December 5th, which is a Monday at the Saban Theater. Please check lfla.org/aloud to learn more. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation, we are a private, nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, innovative programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. If you are not yet a member, I hope that you will consider joining LFLA to continue enjoying programs like this one and to support critical programs like Read Baby Read, High School Online, Adult Literacy, and Tech2Go, which gives anyone with a library card the ability to take out a Chromebook and a hotspot. These programs and initiatives are for Angelenos of all ages that help so many children, teens, and adults improve their lives and achieve their dreams. If LFLA is not in your budget right now, join the Los Angeles Public Library. It's free. With its 73 branches around Los Angeles, each branch provides a space to work, a space to think, a space to grow, and a space to learn without any conditions or questions. Everyone is welcome. We are in a time of question about the direction of our world and our country. This is not the first time that our democracy has been challenged, but with endless access to the internet, words, messages, pictures are transmitted within seconds. Truth is constantly challenged, and to get the truth out is at times impossible. This brings us to tonight's discussion: how lies, censorship, and attacks on journalists are undermining our democracy, both in the U.S. and around the world. Joel Simon is an author, journalist, and press freedom advocate. He is currently a fellow at the Tove Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University and a senior visiting fellow at the Knight First Amendment Institute, also at Columbia University. He's the author of four books, including The Infodemic: How Censorship and Lies Made the World Sicker and Less Free, which you can buy this evening. From 2006 until 2021, Joel served as executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Heidi Ewing and Rachel Grady are the co-directors of Jesus Camp, the Boys of Baraka, 12th and Delaware, Detropia, and Norman Lear, Just Another Version of You, One of Us, another documentary, and Love Fraud, as well as their most recent work, Endangered, which is now playing on HBO. They've won a Peabody and an Emmy Award, as well as being nominated for an Academy and for their work. David Kaye is a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Irvine, and a former United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression from 2014 to 2020. His 2019 book, Speech Police: The Global Struggle to Govern the Internet, explores the ways in which companies, governments, and activists struggle to define the rules for online expression. Please help me welcome our guests. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for that, that introduction there. We have really an amazing discussion tonight. Just three remarkable people to talk about the way in which I think we've been facing over the last several years, as Jessica was just explaining, and I think as probably everybody in this room knows, we've been facing some very serious threats, not only to journalists and to journalism, but to concepts of truth, of fact, of, you know, frankly, democracy. And luckily we had a week last week where we could sort of think about those things in a very focused way. And we've got three people to really walk us through some of these different issues. What we're gonna do tonight, and we're gonna eventually open it up to questions, we want this to be very interactive as much as possible. We're gonna sort of splice into our evening different clips from this amazing documentary that that Heidi and Rachel have put together, Endangered, and I hope you all have a chance to see it fully. But I want to start with one clip that will sort of frame, and it's a very short clip that will get us started in thinking at the sort of the ground level, the way in which sort of the attack on journalism is politically driven and politically based in so many ways. So if we could run this first clip, I think it was. It might have even been clip one, and then we'll launch into a conversation. Great. So maybe we could start with Rachel and Heidi, if you could talk. Just tell us a little bit about why you chose to tell this story about threats to journalism with a global perspective, the one that we see here.
Well, the film, which is called Endangered, and you can see it on HBO Max at your leisure. Rachel and I were talking to our friend Ronan Farrow, who is a journalist and was interested in working with us and finding a project to do together at HBO. And we started just having conversations about, is there a meeting of the minds? Was there something that we were both really interested in and worried about? And sort of we would meet, you know, every now and then. And I'm not sure when it came up, but we started talking about, you know, threats against journalists. But at the time we were talking about places like Russia, like Cuba, like places that you wouldn't be surprised that there's threats against journalists. And over time, the conversation, you know, as the Trump era was marching on, and he was running for re-election and all of that, we started, obviously, we knew all about the sort of attacks on journalists from the president and the cries of fake news, et cetera. And we started to wonder if things weren't starting to look a lot like, you know, Russia and Cuba a little bit over here. And without wanting to conflate or sort of make grand claims, we decided to explore what was it like to be a journalist right now in the Americas, in democracies. So we really sort of came down to our own neighborhoods. We looked at the United States, Mexico, and Brazil in the film, which are, you know, our neighbors and democracies at different phases of their political life. And we thought we would cast some journalists and follow them for 1 year, which we did over the course of the pandemic. We started shooting in March 2020 for a course of 1 year. So it was a very urgent time to be a journalist and for journalism. And the result of the film is the things that you'll see in the clips that we'll talk about tonight.
Yeah. That's great. And the, I mean, these clips in particular, and then when we get to the Trump one, you start to see this kind of personality almost develop, a common personality. So you've got, here you've got AMLO, right? So the president of Mexico, you've got Bolsonaro, president of Brazil. What's common in those two characters, really, particularly if we focus on Mexico and Brazil for the moment?
Well, I mean, if we're
sorry. Here, just pick up the chair. Okay. And now try.
Okay. So, excuse me. I mean, what they have in common in these clips is very much why our film and Joel's book, there's this overlap, this feathering, which is we happen to be filming during the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So the timing, that was just a coincidence, but it turned out that journalists had a different job, like it changed. Everyone in the entire world was telling the same story at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that kind of just put all the things that we were thinking about in stark relief. Mm-hmm. And the fact that political leaders all over the world were trying to control the narrative and were trying to underplay what was going on with this plague. All journalists had that in common, that they were suddenly the bearer of bad news. No one ever likes the bearer of bad news, but in this case, the news was all bad. There was no good news. And leaders of all kinds, governors, presidents, they did not like the press. They did not like them saying the truth because the truth sucked.
Yeah.
So, you know, these two presidents and also the president of was the president of our country, was also saying it, was also saying this is that it's actually the press. The press is making this up. The press is inventing this. Mm-hmm. It's not as big a deal as they're saying. And so suddenly our thesis became, our thesis took over. You know what I mean? It was like a monster.
Right.
And also just like we were casting the film. And so I was on the phone to Spain and we're on the phone to Hungary and then we're on the phone with Margaret Sullivan and we were just trying to figure out what is this movie? And every time you talk to an editor in a foreign country, he'd be like, yes. And they're taking these words from your president, noticia falsa, fake news. They're like, your guy started this. Mm-hmm. And now our guys are using it. And it became, we're like, oh, this is the playbook. And the press was very inconvenient, as Rachel said, to well, to the leadership, and they were all of these, you know, editors around the world were like, this started with you guys, and now we have to contend with it.
So this kind of playbook that you see here, clearly, I mean, you see the results of it. I want to ask Joel to sort of put this in perspective. So I actually brought, you can get a copy after, but I brought my copy of Joel's book, which he already signed. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
But so you wrote a book that really drills down into this, and you know, Rachel was talking about the way in which these leaders just want to control the narrative, but the book sort of paints a pretty nefarious picture. And I wonder if you could.
Yeah. Well, I think let me first of all, you can see why they make such a great team if you saw the microphone getting stuck, and that was a really beautiful moment where you kind of pulled it. Yeah, that's kind of how they work. They're kind of a yin and yang filmmaking duo, and you can see the result of what they produced. But you know, I remember like this, you know, that you guys were sort of casting about and thinking about what the stories you want to tell. And they came to me. At the time I was the executive director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. And I remember, like, when you started, you like, it was a little bit of a kind of, you know, fly on the wall story about CPJ. And you came in to the office and we were having some, like, one of our typical security meetings. I think there was some incident in Colombia, and you came in with the cameras, and I think COVID was just starting, and we were like more worried about what this thing was than like this incident in Colombia. And then I was like, the last, we didn't see you again, because we were all like, everyone had to like kind of regroup. But what happened was, like, the book was came organically out of precisely the situation they were describing. I mean, I was just sitting there in the office. I was at home like everybody else, but sort of looking around the world at what was happening. And, you know, the kind of remark that you made, Heidi, about how, like, dictators and repressive leaders around the world opportunistically embrace the rhetoric that comes from the United States and use it to justify their repressive actions. I mean, we saw that with the war on terror, but, and we you know, and then so, we saw that with fake news, obviously, mm-hmm. that was appropriated. But what was happening was everywhere in the world, this narrative was emerging about this dangerous new disease. And we didn't know that much about it. We didn't really understand it. And so the impulse of every single leader simultaneously around the world is, we've got to take control of this narrative. We can't let the press, the experts, other people define what the reality is. We have to take control. And they had different strategies and mechanisms in order to achieve that. You know, and more in China, obviously, the repression was brutal and direct. And then I think in all these countries, to a greater or lesser extent that you're looking at, Brazil, Mexico, and the United States, the strategy was a little different. Sometimes it's called censorship through noise. It's the idea that you just overwhelm the information system with just trash and junk and lies and confuse people and paralyze them. And it's a form of censorship that could be just as crippling. But the thing that was happening that I just, you know, documented in the book was this, and something we'd never seen before, was a simultaneous crackdown on information through various strategies that was taking place simultaneously everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. And so journalists who were presenting the independent narrative, the counter narrative, became an enemy, and we saw a global crackdown that was unprecedented in its scale and scope, and that's what I wanted to document in the book.
So I want to sort of focus on this part of it for a moment, sort of the whys, like why this desire to control the narrative. So, I mean, we're in LA, so we can make references to fiction, right, as our point, you know, and you remember probably, well, hopefully you saw Contagion, people saw Contagion. So you remember in Contagion, there's this very strong desire to control the narrative, but it's like a public health control. You're like, there's an element to it that you think, well, that's legitimate. You don't want people to panic.
Benevolent. But
it's like, right, benevolent censorship. Yeah. Right, we've just coined a phrase here. But here there's something different. I mean, here it's to control the narrative for what? What is it? Because it's not about just, it's not a public health reason. Nobody would claim that Bolsonaro, AMLO.
Criticism, inevitably, all the leaders were being criticized for not acting quickly enough. Everybody was caught, you know, back on their back foot. And, you know, where you're going to look, you're going to look to your leadership. Where's the vaccine? Where are the controls? Where's the food? What is the supply chain, et cetera? So the criticism all went right to the top, went to the leadership. Fair, not fair. We can talk about that, not tonight. Mm-hmm. And they just all said, there's one culprit here. It's the press, it's that free press. Why, you know, and also the numbers that the governments were giving, which we capture also in Endangered, were not always, it happened in New York, it happened with the nursing homes, it happened with our own Cuomo that we thought was a hero, and then he was a zero, and, you know, so everybody lied, Democrats, Republicans. And so, but there was a journalist out there risking their lives, which you also see in our film that we talk about, to actually just get to the bottom of, like, how many people are dying? Who? What are the ages? Just the basics. Just the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, nothing.
But these were all felt at as massive criticisms and attacks on these mostly male leaders who just, you know, didn't want to hear. They just didn't want to be questioned. And so I think that that's the simplest answer.
Yeah. So it's essentially it's about avoiding criticism, but also retaining power.
That's right.
It became, and yeah. Joel, the way you just described, there's sort of also the noise that's thrown out there is something.
Well, I mean, it's obviously it's about retaining power, but let's just analyze it in the context of the United States, okay? I mean, each your dynamic was slightly different. But these are monumental events that overwhelm the best laid political plan. So in the United States, this is just one example. We could talk about Brazil, we could talk about Mexico, we could talk about China, we could talk about Iran, we could talk about Russia. Each one of these leaders had their own vision of how they wanted to manage the future. But in the United States, of course, Trump was running on a strong economy and on a booming stock market and on, you know, a whole bunch of issues that he thought, you know, were winning for him politically. And all of a sudden, this disease emerges, and he's got to make some tough decisions, which are going to be politically costly for him.
Right.
You know, this is the same dynamic, of course, in Brazil. He did not want to make those decisions.
Yeah.
And so the more information that was thrown at him about the necessity of making some tough calls to protect public health, the more he thought, we have to suppress this information, and we have to continue to focus on what's important to me politically, which is the booming economy, in his own mind. Let me be clear about that. It wasn't a booming economy in his own mind. It was a booming economy that he thought was going to be the kind of political impetus for his reelection. And so if you kind of get into his head, what strategy does he have to overwhelm and suppress information? He can't control levers of censorship. So he just throws out all this crap and denialism and lies and misinformation and overwhelms that whole infrastructure of news. And, you know, that was his motivation. And so many leaders around the world followed that gameplay. Right.
Also, we were always the bastion. It was always United States, free speech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Come here, free speech. We were like, that was our deal. This was our thing.
Yeah.
And all the democracies lined up like, all right, you know, we're not going to get trouble with the United States. Well, that was over suddenly. And everyone else looked around. They're like, why are we being like, why are we following these rules? They're not.
Right.
So just very, very quickly, everybody just lined and they just all abandoned it and started attacking their press. It happened that quickly.
So maybe we should look at the second clip.
Make sure it's the Trump one.
Yeah, exactly. So it's number two, clip number two. So clip number two, this one, we're like going backwards,
yeah.
Right? Because, you know, COVID didn't happen in a vacuum. In a sense, Trump kind of laid the groundwork for blaming the press and blaming others for the narrative, right? But if we look at
before COVID.
Yeah, before COVID, all of that stuff was sort of, so that by the time COVID happens, you know, he's kind of prepared people, like who's gonna be blamed here.
Sure.
If we look at clip two and then we can talk a little bit about what's going on there.
Okay, it's a comedy.
Right. Clearly, there's a trauma there. I mean, really, in a way, right? And so walk us through, maybe, Joel, if you could sort of, how did this sort of happen? You know, and you know, what I mean is, you know, we saw this, you know, serious demonization of the press, and it resonated with this audience. Can you maybe connect that to some of the themes in the Infodemic and how you see that and how it played out in the work that you were doing?
Well, I mean, I think that there are some, you know, there are so many factors that went into making the press into an effective punching bag. But, you know, politicians have always run campaigns against the press. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of par for the course. Yeah. And they've always, when they do that, they always have a similar narrative, which is that the press represents elite interests. The press is a kind of unelected power. Right. The press is corrupt. But I think that what started to happen was, the kind of traditional media in the United States and around the world, you know, it was sort of defined by, obviously, you know, the broadcast networks which reached mass audience, and then metropolitan newspapers whose mission was to maximize the size of their audience in a specific geographic area. So they wanted to appeal to Republicans and Democrats, and so the whole notion, the whole idea of journalistic objectivity, that's a marketing strategy, which worked at a certain moment in time because it was a strategy to maximize readers who would then, you know, that would be an effective way for advertisers to reach those people. But the information sort of infrastructure just split and fragmented and moved online. And so that strategy no longer made sense. And so we started moving into our own information bubbles. And so politicians like Trump, you know, saw that there was this kind of opportunity to basically portray the media as the political enemy because it represented the views of what, you know, what he perceived as political adversaries. And this is a strategy we've seen, I observed at CPJ, in a lot of places where democracy disintegrated. You know, in Venezuela, in Russia, in Turkey, the first thing that political leaders who are looking to consolidate power to do is kind of dismiss the press, and they always do it as the press represents the, you know, a political opposition and not a kind of independent arbiter of truth. And that was the opportunity that Trump exploited. I think a lot of people knew it was there.
Yeah,
including in the Republican Party, but they just weren't willing to exploit that for their own political benefit. Mm-hmm. And that's always the case with Trump. He would go places that nobody else would go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that was the result.
Right.
And, you know, the thing is, you documented this. It's so powerful in Endangered. But, you know, when you talk to journalists who were at the other end of that, you know, everyone pointing and yelling and screaming, I mean, it was terrifying.
It's scary. Oh, no, I mean, the scene right after this is like this journalist, this British guy from The Guardian who was covering, he had the worst beat of anyone in our film. Poor British guy for The Guardian, not even his own country or problem, was assigned to the South, and he was tracking Trump's reelection. And he was treated this way repeatedly.
Constantly.
Mm-hmm. Sworn at, and the next scene after this, he calls his sister, and they're like, you should just come home. Why are you doing this? And he doesn't have a good answer.
Is this something that you saw, because you documented, and this is really a traumatic scene or set of images, and you know, you start with that one guy saying, you know, what he's being questioned about, do you know what the impeachment is? Well, you know, I saw this on YouTube, I mean, which is funny, but I'm wondering if in the Brazilian or the Mexico context, did you see a similar kind of resistance to the media as gatekeeper? I mean, that's putting it
right. High, well, in Brazil, like, 1,000%.
Yeah,
yeah. Brazil and Bolsonaro and Trump are you know, mirrored each other, and our journalist in Brazil, Patricia Campos Melo, was actually being directly harassed by the president. She had broken a story that was not flattering to him about his first, when he was elected president, and he just really had a bee in his bonnet over her. He couldn't stand her, and spread lies about her, disparaging things, saying that she traded sex for stories about him. And but there is definitely a very intense and, you know, right-wing part of the population that has the press is like have been extremely demonized. And to the point where they know the names of journalists, they have pictures of journalists at rallies, and it's really, really intense, and I think quite dangerous for them.
It's frightening.
The Mexico, just to add on to that, the Mexico dynamic is different. Of course, every country is different, and in Mexico, the news deserts are mostly places where the narcotraficantes have the power. So in Chihuahua, Sonora, there's most of the places that no longer have journalists are major central areas for drug trafficking. That's not a coincidence, of course, because the cartels killed journalists. Or there's enough scary threats that the journalists stop operating there. Or the narcos also control the news gathering organizations and they just shut them. So in Mexico, all of the ire and the danger against journalists has mostly been focused on those who are trying to cover issues surrounding drug trafficking. But with the pandemic, you start seeing, even in Mexico City where our journalist is operating, you start seeing the government turning on journalists in a new fashion. And so that actually was new in Mexico.
Well, and also it sort of complicates the left-right issue in the sense that AMLO's a left.
He's a progressive hero, of course, and the way that Lula is. I mean, it's hard to compare all these people, but he was one of the good guys, you know?
I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's non-ideological. It was the threat of independent information. You know, you have the greatest COVID deniers are, Ortega in Nicaragua and, the government in Iran and Russia. And, so this is not an ideological framework at all. It's really about independent information. And, AMLO uses the same strategy that Bolsonaro uses and that Trump uses, was to discredit and undermine and ridicule. And he's got this, the thing about AMLO, he's like, the other thing, all three of these figures, they're like communication geniuses. And they're also very effective users of social media, which is something we haven't talked about that much, which is like an incredible and strategy for bypassing these gatekeepers that politicians have used it and sort of corrupted the information space. But he's got this press conference that he does every morning at 7:30, called El Mañanero. And he would just get up and he would just dominate. It's brilliant because it starts at 7:30 in the morning. So like before anyone's like oriented themselves to the news, and he makes journalists get up early, which I gotta say they hate to do. And they'll come to the Mexican version of the White House, it's called Los Pinos, and he would just ramble on for like 45 minutes and live stream, and he would set the agenda for the day.
So I want to, there's another clip that I want to show, but before we get to that, I feel like this is pretty grim. So I want to ask you, Joel, first, and then to Rachel and Heidi, ask you a similar question, but from a different perspective. What's the response to this? So, given the amount of power, the amount of control that leaders like this have, to sort of the public's credit in both the United States and in Brazil, there's been pushback. But what is the pushback? What's the response to all of this noise, this attack on journalists? What are a couple of policy or public or even what journalists should be doing to push back against this kind of demonization?
Well, let me start with a slightly different point, which is that, and this is something I'm really, kind of tried to evaluate in the book. I mean, pandemics change the world. We're still not far enough out to really understand the way in which the world has been transformed, but it's definitely reoriented the information space in really dramatic ways. But recent events, are complicating the picture tremendously, right? We've just had an election in this country in which all the kind of worst case scenarios did not play out. And, I'm not speaking about it from like a partisan perspective, but people who, denied you know, election deniers did not fare well. Mm-hmm. That's obviously positive. Bolsonaro just lost an election in Brazil and was, reluctantly compelled to, I wouldn't call it a concession,
not
but
really.
Just, like kind of at least, you know,
skulk away.
Yeah. But he's not done skulking yet.
Right.
But the thing that we have to be very, I think they're I'm worried about a kind of sense of complacency because it all of a sudden it's very reassuring that it seems so normal. But the reality is, number one, just in this country, a lot of the information structures that were on the surface have moved, have shifted, and they're not as visible to us anymore. Mm-hmm. So the, 30% of Trump voters, they're not on Twitter anymore. They're on Truth Social or whatever, or they're on their Telegram channels, or they're on their WhatsApp channels. So they're communicating with each other, and they're below the surface.
Right.
And they're less visible. So I obviously they're a minority, and you know that's reflected in what's happened. And then the other thing that happened, just from a geopolitical sense, is I think the timing of Russia's invasion in Ukraine was partially dictated by the pandemic. I think Putin used the pandemic to consolidate power in Russia. Using all these repressive strategies that he employed under the guise of protecting public health. And he perceived that Europe and the West were in complete disarray because he was watching the COVID dysfunction play out. And he had a whole variety of reasons why he thought this was the opportune moment. But this was one of them. And then, of course, the response to that invasion and the kind of democracy reaffirming kind of a reaction of the Ukrainians and of Europe as a whole completely shifted the global landscape, right? But let's not forget that China has effectively used COVID to consolidate power and to crush the independent media in Hong Kong. You know, that the election in the Philippines was won by, you know, a kind of a typical autocratic populist the son of the former president, that there are so many counterexamples. Mm-hmm. So I think it is important that we celebrate the victories, but I think we have to also look around the world and understand that we're so reassured by this kind of sense of normalcy that it can cause us to be complacent.
Can I just throw in one little thing here?
Yeah.
And now CNN's been told to be nicer.
Oh.
So if you look, as you guys watch the Jake Tapper looked like he was like a deer in the headlights. Mm. Like there have been a marked direction over at CNN for everyone to just be nicer about the treat the both parties exactly the same. So you're seeing something happen over there, which is, I don't know if I'd call it censorship, but sort of there's definitely
a corporate vision
of like what people actually want to hear, which is no, don't rock the boat. Both sides have exactly the same point. So you're seeing some eruptions here in our own media that who knows how they're going to end.
But Heidi, is there a way in which, kind of what you're suggesting is there was pushback. And is that like, is there a kind of pushback that you see in all the journalists that you talk to in producing Endangered? Mm-hmm. Was there a sense that, like, okay, here's the game plan for dealing with this kind of attack from political leaders? So you had Jake Tapper as one example.
I just threw that in because that's a new thing that's happening on CNN, and it's fun to talk about and watch, and it's super weird. But with the pushback, Joel can tell you, when he was running the Committee to Protect Journalists, there is no safety training for American journalists. Mm-hmm. We've never had to have it. That was like, the CPJ was like operating in countries that you would expect them to be operating in. And suddenly, as we were making this film, we recorded your daily calls, and suddenly you were getting hundreds of calls from American journalists. How do I get a gas mask? What do I do to protect myself? I'm being followed. Someone's threatening me on internet saying they're going to rape and kill my family. Literally no experience. And so I know you're asking about pushback. I would venture to say that there's a chilling effect.
Yeah.
For anyone entering the profession, those who are already in the profession, they certainly don't think that everything is good now that we won the Senate barely by the hair of our chinny chin chin. That's terrific. Yeah. I don't think journalists are feeling like, we're good now. Because so much darkness has come at them that I do, I fear a chilling effect about coverage and also who's going to enter the profession. I don't know if that's something you want to comment on, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that would be my, that is my one, that's my, this is my one trick pony when people are like, what can happen?
What do we do?
Like, more journalists, just get more journalists, just encourage people to be journalists. Mm-hmm. Just volume, we need bodies. We need like reporter bodies.
Should we maybe look at the last clip just to sort of demonstrate? So in a way, if we've been looking at sort of this very high level, like whipping up, and then you have in this last clip, this sense of actually what that means when, you know, in the context of protest and the militarization of the police. Let's just look at that, and then we'll talk for a minute about that and then open it up to questions. So if we could run clip 3. Joel, you spent your career protecting journalists around the world, counting journalists jailed, killed, et cetera. So there's a way in which this is really bad, but it's also a little bit different to a certain extent than what you've seen around the world. But what is it that's going on here? Is this a result of kind of the Trumpian language of whipping up the public, or is there something deeper that is in a way even maybe more problematic?
Well, both. But let me just say, you know, in reference to what Heidi was just talking about, like this was what the journalists were calling. I mean, they were out there covering these protests, and you know, these were violent, violent responses from the police. I mean, there were something like 129 journalists arrested covering the social justice protests, Black Lives Matter protests. Hundreds of physical assaults committed against journalists by police. Direct targeting, you saw that. So this was an incredibly violent violent response. Obviously, it was. It's partially the same dynamic that we just discussed, which was that, you know, police were deploying very violent responses against the protesters themselves, and they refused to distinguish between protesters and journalists, even though they had a constitutional obligation, even when they were dispersing crowds, to allow journalists to cover these events. So, I mean, I think they were fueled by the kind of Trumpian rhetoric, the kind of general hostility towards the press, the kind of calls by Trump himself to use force. So there were so many different dynamics at play. But this is the thing that's interesting, because I'm doing a research project this year at Columbia looking at the history of the interaction between police and journalists at protests going back to the civil rights era. And the thing that, you know this because you're, you know, a constitutional lawyer, but the rights of journalists covering protests are not secure at all. And every time in American history that you see mass protests, particularly when police deploy violence, journalists are caught up in that. And so these were the largest protests in American history. And so we don't have data that's comprehensive, but I think it's a fair assumption. This was the largest level of violence and arrests committed by journalists against journalists, by police committed against journalists. But that's a systemic challenge, and it's a legal challenge, and it's a structural challenge.
Yeah. Rachel, when you're sort of displaying this, and when you're talking to journalists in the field who are facing these kinds, and we're talking a little bit about this kind of chilling, did you see that in your discussions with the journalists? I mean, the last journalist who, are they cowed? Are they sort of huddling and resisting going back out into the field, or is it, I mean, you know, what's going on from that?
The journalists that, the specific journalists that we were following did not, but I think that it does happen. Yeah, especially when people start threatening your family, and I think that really spooks people for obvious reasons, but that happens, you know? I mean, Patricia was in Brazil is like followed and harassed, and you know, Ollie's been spit on, and like, I think it does, yeah, it does undermine you. It's definitely deflating. And I'm sure it makes people quit and want to do something else.
I mean, even our journalists, to be fair, I mean, if you look at the four of them in the film, one of them takes a sabbatical, Patricia, to New York at a nice opportune time to get the F out for a minute. She goes for a year. Ollie, who's like the youngest journalist in our crop, was having serious second thoughts about maybe going back to England. Carl, who you just saw in that clip, is thinking of retiring. And Sashenka, who's the purple-haired photojournalist, is like, I don't know how to do anything else. Aquí me quedo, you know, I'm going to stay. So I would say that actually even in our like intrepid journalists, they all were sort of at, there's definitely an inflection point. I don't think you'll see any of them quitting, but they were actually forced to ask themselves some serious questions over the course of the filming.
And I'm going to turn to questions in just a second, but one thing that Joel mentioned that we haven't really talked about is the effect of social media on all of this. Is it common across the places that you looked at in Endangered that you have the, sort of the high level, the, you know, presidents doing all this whipping up, but also the trolling? What you see was this, and what kind of effect did that have?
The trolling is terrible. Really bad. The trolling, I think, is what really undermines, spooks the individuals.
Yeah,
because they start. It's anonymous. It's threatening. It's relentless.
Yeah,
you know, it is humiliating.
Yeah.
I think that it's a real danger, and it's a real thing. Yes.
Yeah.
It's really hard to control. Right. You know.
The only thing I'll add to that is, I mean, if you've ever been, and I've had just tastes of this, like, if you've ever been kind of a target in a systematic harassment campaign, you think you're gonna like be tough and kind of be like, okay, mm-hmm. it's just words, whatever. But it mm-hmm. really eats into you and really gets at you and really undermines your ability to do your job and really makes you feel paranoid and angry and frustrated and like you lost control. It's an incredibly effective strategy that you know, the enemies, and it's often, the other thing is it's almost never spontaneous. It's often orchestrated and often by political leaders, so it's a strategy that they use to intimidate and censor their critics. But the only thing I'll say about this, and you know this, David, as a free expression advocate and defender, the solutions are not simple. Right. You know, this is not, if this were a simple problem sure. to solve, we would have solved it a long time ago because it is so debilitating. But you know, it's there's an element of it mm-hmm. in which people are expressing themselves. So you know, that's part of the challenge is that people feel helpless.
Are you trying to say that Elon Musk doesn't have the answers?
Elon Musk has all the answers.
Yeah, Elon Musk.
We learned that in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, right.
No, I love that. Like, first we thought like Mark Zuckerberg was gonna like solve our problems in life.
Yeah.
Then now it's Elon. I'm like, y'all, the genie's out of the bottle.
Right.
So I don't like, this is something, maybe it's a different panel. I don't know where I come down on like how much you're supposed to censor the like what it's like whack-a-mole. I don't know how it's gonna go down.
Yeah. Well, let's go to I think there should be some microphones that'll be circulating. Why don't we go back here, gentleman in the red jacket first?
I got a lot of voice.
Oh, here.
Project.
Were there repercussions?
People at home for
We're streaming. Yeah.
Okay. Were there repercussions against any of the police departments for any of these arrests, or did they get away with it?
Great question.
Oh, so were there repercussions for the police department, for police departments around the country? No. I would say there's been no accountability. There's been some legal reform. There was a settlement in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that basically. Under the terms of that settlement, the police had to pay some compensation to journalists, and they had to reform some of their practices. There was a similar lawsuit in Portland. There's a new law here in California, actually, that is supposed to guarantee the rights of journalists to cover protests. So there's been some legal response, and some of it is actually positive, but I would say there's been zero accountability.
Mm-hmm. Great. Right here, please. Just wait, Mike is coming for you.
Thank you. Hey, Jorge. My question was, were there any news outlets that were shut down for their reporting of Corona? I know that there were journalists that were harassed and maybe fired, but were there any outlets as a whole that were shut down?
In the United States?
Or around the world?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know definitely in the United States, things were closed because of economic reasons, you know. I don't think so. No. I don't know in the United States. I mean,
yeah,
Joel
no,
might
I'm
know
not. I'm not aware of any media outlet that was shut down in direct response for critical reporting. I mean, that's kind of not the kind of toolbox that political leaders have available to them in this country, but around the world, you bet. You know, Egypt. You know, China. Many independent bloggers in China. That's something I write about in my book. Who there was a small group of independent bloggers who actually went to Wuhan and were able to document some of the things that were happening at the outbreak of the pandemic at a time when China was denying, you know, that it was serious or that they had it under control, and then claiming that they had it under control. So there was, you know, significant repression targeting media outlets and individual journalists around the world, but I'm not aware of anything that was specifically shut down.
I thought it was interesting recently during what we saw happen in Russia when the war broke out with the Ukraine, how quickly the mediums were closed and journalists have left, basically. It took really that for Russia to really lay it all down. Pandemic wasn't enough.
So this is a very complicated area, too, because I mean, the mention of Ukraine is really interesting because not only has Russia imposed these are non-COVID related, but, you know, they've basically shut down independent media. But Europe also has completely banned, and this is across Europe, they've banned Russian state media. Now, you could say, well, that's not independent media, but it's also, you know, a kind of a signal of the way in which Europeans are treating the flow of information and the flow of propaganda.
I mean, they've geo-blocked it. You can't get it. You can't get it.
So broadcasters have been ordered not to show RT and Sputnik.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Search links can't be shown to RT and Sputnik. So you can't go on social and find any of these. You'd have to use a VPN.
What's your feeling about that from a free speech?
How do I feel?
I feel bad. How do you feel? Yeah. I mean, what is your opinion?
No, exactly. I mean, so this is, I think it's what it's showing is something that Joel was suggesting before, that some of the, like on the one hand, there's this major repression and attacks and endangerment of the media. And so there's a way in which we want to say, well, we should be addressing that in a robust way. But the answer sometimes, so the answer that Europeans adopted in the face of Russian disinformation, sure, which is a very serious thing, was to simply say we're shutting down all this media. And to my mind, it's problematic in two ways. One, it's disproportionate, right? Mm-hmm. So there may be other ways than shutting down an entire network. Although I was in Europe a couple of weeks ago, and somebody from NATO sort of harassed me about this and said, well, you don't really know what we're seeing coming from Russia, which, you know, frankly might be true, but it highlights how difficult the issue is.
They're very sloppy solutions.
They are. Everything's so ham-handed. Yeah, very sloppy. It's always that you have to cut the head off, you know, and it's hard.
Exactly.
I mean, that's why.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I would point out, though, is, you know, if you're talking about RT, I mean, you may know that the primary, so RT, for those of you who are not aware of it, is this kind of Kremlin-run Russian propaganda, and Kremlin-finance, not Kremlin-run, entity that is sophisticated. Like, you know, some of its news reporting is accurate, and some of it is not. And it's a kind of sophisticated propaganda operation. And in the United States, there's a law in this country that allows entities that are basically lobbying on behalf of foreign governments to be labeled as foreign agents. It's called the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And so the U.S. Justice Department decided, well, this is a Russian propaganda entity. You know, we're going to compel them to label as foreign agents. And you might recall that in Russia, all of these entities that are being shut down are being accused of being foreign agents. Yeah. So that's not a coincidence. So yes, it's true that we haven't censored RT, but we've created this framework, going back to our initial discussion, where, you know, authoritarian governments will weaponize anything that we do to restrict the media, and that's exactly what Russia has done in this case.
Yeah. That's great. We have one more question we got time for. Great. In the back over here. Sorry, on the left, in the pink or salmon shirt, right there. Okay. It's hard for me to see exact color here.
Okay. Thank you. My question is, when journalism tries to be fair and balanced, and like on climate change, they have the scientist who, and 99% agree with them, and then they have the climate denier, and how do you get to showing the other side, but then also saying, you know, this is pretty much debunked? Yeah.
Why don't you answer that?
I'm going to say, I think this is a little bit of an apocryphal story at this point. I think this is a myth. I haven't seen a story in a long time in like traditional media where they have a kind of climate denier quoted alongside recognized experts who acknowledge that climate change is real. I mean, there are certainly entities out there that make that claim, but I don't think you're seeing that kind of quote unquote balance. I think we're in a media information kind of segregated information system where there's definitely some media that give lots of airtime and visibility to election deniers, and there are lots of mainstream media that completely ignore those kinds of claims. And there's not a lot these days that say, you know, these people say the election was legitimate, and to balance that perspective, you know, we're going to quote an election denier. I'm not sure that's the way the media works these days, honestly. I think it's kind of, it's more fragmented than that.
But I wonder if there's a way in which there's this broader question about the kind of both sidesing of
that's
democracy.
What I feel like that's what your question is for, right?
So
they call it whataboutism.
A kind of a whataboutism, yeah. Which is more, so I agree with Joel that there's, although it's taken the media some time to get to this place,
but
I agree with your conclusion, but I wonder if in terms of, and you see a lot of criticism of the Times, of I know we're in LA and we should say that LA Times versus, but of the New York Times, of sort of not, you know, getting, drilling down into the real threats to democracy. And I wonder if you see any of that in the sort of the broader media landscape.
Well, they just started to pay attention to this issue.
That's what we were talking last week about something else, and there are democracy beats that are being created, you know, that is like a climate change beat or a whatever. There are reporters now that are doing focusing on democracy because now it's something that people have like actually thinking
Joel
about.
Skeptical.
I hate to end on a contrarian note, but I'm a contrarian, so what can I say? Look, I mean, I think that that I celebrate the creation of these democracy beats. They're so important, and it's great that the Times is committed to doing this sort of thing. But the problem is we're fighting about the narrative that's set in this information bubble that we all share. So, like, it really doesn't
matter. If you've got a subscription to the New York Times, you don't need the democracy beat.
Exactly. I think the New York Times could cover democracy better, but they're not changing anyone's mind.
No.
And that's we're fighting over, like, how the New York Times, I think we should fight over this, how the New York Times frames its coverage of these issues, or the LA Times for that matter. But what really matters is, you know, and this is something that I kind of grapple with in the book, is people consume information as part of a community. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of part of a community of New York Times readers that have a certain, or LA Times readers that have a certain reality. But if you're outside of that group, and most of the people who are election deniers are, it really doesn't matter how the New York Times covers the story. The question we should be asking is, how can we reach those people, and what is the, you know, that's...
Democracy beat people in local news. That's okay. What I'm saying. In local news.
I love it.
Yes.
I love
local
it.
In
news.
Arizona,
okay, so that's
and in Nevada, and in other places that have nothing to do with, you know, East Coast readers.
100%.
And I think we've kind of hit the end of our time, if I'm reading right over here, Tiffany. So
thank you for coming, though. Let's thank them for coming in.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Thank you all for participating in this discussion. I want to just encourage you to first watch Endangered. You could see from the clips just how meaningful it'll be. There's a grimness to it, but I think there's also this element of really showing what's happening that's the first step to solving. And then please read Joel's book. I think afterwards copies will be available out front, and maybe he'll even sign some for you. It's a fantastic book. And again, thanks everybody for coming, and look forward to the next Allowed event to see you at.
Thank you, David, for everything. Thank you all, and yes, check out HBO Max for Endangered, and Joel, you will be signing in the lobby, and please come to the Patti Smith on Monday, December 5th. We have tickets available, and she will be going through her sort of Instagram book and talking with the audience, and also playing many songs. So please join us. Thank you so much for being here. Bye.
Allowed is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.